From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. A federal court decision has consequences for copyright and fair use issues in the college curricula. And across the country, we see both thoughtful and fearful campus responses to the threat of Ebola. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation today, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our opening segment today, we're going to talk about copyright, colleges, and the courts. Copyright can be contentious in an era of technological disruption, especially when litigation can set the boundaries for that disruption. Late last week, a federal appeals court, in a unanimous decision, pushed back on a lower court decision that previously affirmed the efforts of Georgia State University to, quote, thread the needle between copyright protection for authors and publishers and digital access for e-reserves for students. In its review of a fair use claim for e-reserves, the U.S. Appeals Court for the 11th Circuit rejected a, quote, quantitative approach to fair use, 10% of the content or one chapter of a book. Rather, while affirming the doctrine of fair use, particularly as it applies to educational institutions, the court also cautioned against a formulaic or one-size-fits-all approach for higher education. The court's decision is limited to three states in its jurisdiction, Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. But Friday's decision also casts a very large shadow over the copyright conversation that involves campuses and content providers as these parties and others negotiate the new terrain of copyright and digital content. Joining us for this conversation today are Nancy Sims, who is the copyright program librarian at the University of Minnesota. Nancy also scribes the popular Copyright Librarian blog. And Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Two, I should note that we extended an invitation to the Association of American Publishers to join us for this conversation, and they passed on that invitation. So, Nancy, let me begin with you. What did the Federal Appeals Court decide, and why does it matter?
Thanks. The Federal Appeals Court, from one light, overturned the ruling that course uses were fair uses. And so the decision actually vacated the lower court's decision. The lower court had said that the university had prevailed, was the winner, and the circuit court overruled that as well. However, they didn't really say there was no fair use. What they said was the lower court's analysis was not entirely correct. So what that means is the case is going to go back to the lower court. The lower court will have to reconsider all of the very detailed considerations they made in the first place and perhaps rule again. It matters because it applies directly in the states in the 11th Circuit, but lots of other states also look to the 11th Circuit case as an informative opinion because there's not a whole lot of law about the fair use doctrine in educational uses.
Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, this seems to cast a very large shadow. Again, the court's decision, as Nancy said, applies to just the three states, but there seems to be a lot of writing on the blogs, Nancy's blog and others, and a lot of chatter about the shadow that this decision casts in terms of campus planning and policy for copyright, and particularly for e-reserves.
Yes, because one of the things that many librarians and academics generally liked about the lower court's decision was that it sort of carved out a safe harbor and said if it's not over 10%, if it's not more than one chapter, you're likely fine in most cases. Colleges and universities really like safe harbors in any sort of legal analysis because they don't want a situation where a librarian, upon receiving an e-reserve request from a professor, has to convene a panel of lawyers. And so the case-by-case approach suggested in the appeals court decision could make it much tougher for colleges. And many times colleges, when they don't have safe harbors, get very nervous about any legal issue and say, let's just not go there. I don't think they can afford to do that and just eliminate e-reserves, but many liked the simplicity of the lower court's decision.
Nancy, I want to come back to something that you said and also something that was in the court decision. In the court decision, there was a lot of conversation about market harm, that e-reserve might do damage to the copyright holders in terms of the value of the content. And also, in your blog and in other blogs, there was this issue in terms of the court decision. It was sent back to the lower courts, not on the merits, but on the process. Help us understand these two issues. First, market harm, and then merit versus process in this decision.
Sure. Market harm is often a fair use factor that courts find important. There are four factors written down in the statute that are supposed to be the things that you have to think about in order to determine if a use is a fair use. Market harm is the last factor, but it is, as I said, it's something courts often place a lot of weight on. In Judge Evans' district court opinion, she did actually place quite a bit of weight on market harm. She sort of indicated if there's a license available for a digital use of course materials, you maybe should pay it. She wasn't entirely clear about when exactly you would need to pay it and when you might have fair use even in the existence of a license, but she considered it. What the court in the 11th Circuit said was she didn't consider it heavily enough. And that's a little bit challenging for me and for other people at universities in particular, for instructors, if instructors are trying to guess about fair use, because what they have to do then is maybe we're not exactly sure what it means in practice yet, but maybe instructors need to check and see if they could pay for a license. That's not something most instructors can do. So that makes life a little bit difficult. And they also, there's a lot of weight in this court. They go back and forth on whether market harm is the most important factor. One challenging thing about market harm is that if you say it's not fair use if they're willing to sell it to you, then you wipe out fair use, because anybody who's willing to sell you anything can wipe out a fair use. So courts recognize that, and the 11th Circuit did recognize that in their opinion. But on the other hand, the 11th Circuit said, but, you know, licenses are really important, and we don't want to wipe out the market for licenses. So it's going to be a really hard balance for the court, the lower court, to strike on remand. As far as the process goes, Judge Evans took a lot of time to make her decision in the first place and did a very painstaking analysis. And basically the court said, you did a good job on a lot of it, but here's some things you need to do differently. And they're pretty detailed things that they want her to do differently. So it'll be a real challenge in the lower court to redo the process.
And Scott, as I've read a lot of the commentary about this, the original article in Inside Higher Ed and a number of the blogs, depending on who you read determines what you understand about this case. Some observers say it was still a win for universities because the court upheld the concept of fair use. Others say it was a win for the publishers or a partial win. I mean, how do you score this?
I think it's at least a partial win for the publishers. Look, the lower court's decision was a pretty full victory for Georgia State and librarian interests. And it's important to say here, Georgia State's policies were similar to those of many other colleges and universities. It's not like Georgia State was some outlier, so it doesn't matter what happens here. And so it's certainly true, as we've been saying here today, that they didn't deny the concept of fair use, but they sort of raised the bar. They said, you know, more case-by-case analysis. You have to look at what's available elsewhere and so forth. And I think what this points to is that a lot of what goes on in academia, whether it's the teaching side of e-reserves or the research side, there's some real tensions right now between publishers and the consumers of what publishers create. And a lot of librarians, a lot of academics are frustrated by a sense that they're paying a lot frequently for information that their institutions created in the form of scholarship and textbooks. So there's some underlying issues here that are very much at play beyond just the pure legal issues.
Nancy, court decisions create what many would call a morning after problem. I'm thinking, for example, going back to, I believe it was 1991, the Kinko's decision, where the court said Kinko's couldn't copy materials for course packs, and that was a big step and a big win for the publishers. They might have celebrated that night, but the problem didn't go away the morning after, and the problem doesn't go away the morning after in terms of the Georgia State decision. Since the Kinko's decision, and that was really about print, not digital content, we have seen some elements of an infrastructure emerge that become clearinghouses or middle sources, the Copyright Clearance Center and other vehicles that, that allow institutions, librarians, faculty members to say, I need this article, I need this chapter, how do I go about doing that? What are the drawbacks of the existing mechanism now as it's moved from print to digital?
Well, one drawback is that quite a few of the academic publishers have not been offering digital licenses. They have at certainly at the time that the district court opinion came out, a good bit of the readings that they were looking at in that court opinion were not available for licensing for digital use. If you wanted to pay a license for your students to read those chapters, you could only pay for them to have access to a print copy. Unfortunately, students really don't want print copies. Actually, that's not true. Lots of them like to read on paper, but they want to be able to access it online. So one thing that has been happening since the district court opinion is that more of the publishers are offering licenses for digital uses. And actually, we've been making pretty heavy use of that here at the University of Minnesota as we've been trying to develop a system that integrates the library's subscriptions and fair use and open access readings and paid licensed readings.
Scott, as you've been scanning the landscape in the wake of the Georgia State decision, you know, what's the impact on faculty and students? If I'm a faculty member at Georgia State, you know, what's the morning after consequence for me and for my courses?
Well, I mean, it obviously depends how this all plays out, because this case has been going on for a long time, and I'd say as a result of the new decision, it's going to go on for a long more time to come. But faculty members are, one, under pressure from their students, and in some cases from their institutions, to have low-cost educational tools. Faculty members are trying not to just randomly assign textbooks or readings without regard to cost. So free access e-reserves satisfy a lot of the pressures that they're under. If they now have to jump through more hoops to make an e-reserve, they're going to be frustrated, and if that prompts them not to make use of free e-reserves, their students are going to be frustrated. And then there's the underlying problem that an awful lot of students don't read what they're assigned in any format at all. So you've got a lot of pressures on people, and at the same time, publishers, while some publishers may do quite well, others don't do so well. And academics want publishers to be healthy too. So you have got a range of pressures, a range of issues. I also think extended litigation may not help anyone because there's such a prolonged period of uncertainty.
Nancy, it seems that the court issues involve two buckets or two topics. The first, in the remand back to the lower court, is give us something other than the 10% rule. Scott said that campuses like the safe harbor of hard metrics because it provides guidelines and that they can fall back on to protect and defend. The court said you got to do something other than this 10% rule. And then there seems to be other issues, particularly as it relates to digital content, that will sort of muddle the courts both at the district level and potentially work its way back up through higher levels of courts. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's probably a fair assessment. The 10% mark is an interesting one because I would say that I'm not sure that many librarians, I think probably a large number of librarians and faculty members liked the idea of a safe harbor, but most of the people I know who think about this really hard didn't like the 10% number. That's a very low percentage, and when you look at the case law across fair use, courts are often willing to accept more than 10%, in some cases 100%, when the purpose is really, you know, really good, really critical, really transformative. And so a lot of us were uncomfortable with this idea of the 10% boundary because there are times when there are some really critical pedagogical uses that are very transformative that involve using a larger portion of the work that we thought seemed like fair use. And the circuit court analysis actually seems to consider that. There may be times when fair use is bigger than 10%. Even in the educational context, even with the market harm analysis they applied. There's also a lot of this decision that's going to be very difficult to work through on lots of the other very subtle points that the court raised, some of which have to do with the digital market, some of which are just a more subtle and nuanced analysis of the fair use factors than the lower court opinion engaged in.
All right. And to both of you, let me begin first with Scott. What does this say about the continuing sort of leapfrogging that occurs between copyright law and technological capacity, and how technology seems to disrupt copyright law at every step of the way?
Well, I mean, it's a perfect illustration of how laws that were originally created, or concepts that were created in a pre-digital era, don't always neatly translate when technology advances. But if you look at the way students are using materials digitally, want access to digital materials, it's going to continue to be a point of tension.
And Nancy, if generals and are fighting, always fighting the last war, it seems in this instance, the courts and Congress in the conversation about copyright are also fighting the last war, or the last iteration of technological capacity, as opposed to where it's going. What's the remedy here? What needs to be done?
One of the things, actually, I like fair use for situations exactly like this. When you talk to people internationally about fair use, a lot of them will say that fair use, this flexibility, this weird case-by-case unpredictability, is actually one of the things that enables tech innovation in the United States. Because instead of waiting for legislation in the United States, if you have a plausible fair use argument and you're willing to take on the risk of possibly having to litigate it, you can make tech innovations without waiting for legislative approval, and you can do this without necessarily waiting for legal review through a court if you are, as I say, willing to take on the risks. So I think that fair use is actually a really interesting and useful tool for dealing with technological innovations, because it's so flexible, because it's so unpredictable. I don't know that legislative reform is going to get to a better solution than that. And it's not perfect for everybody at any point. You know, sometimes it's disappointing from my end, sometimes it's disappointing from other ends of the conversation. But the flexibility and the unpredictability go hand in hand, and they actually do some really good things for our country's innovative economy.
Great. Nancy and Scott, thank you for an engaging and informative conversation. In our second segment today, we're going to discuss the campus response to Ebola. Scan the headlines, and the campus response to Ebola in recent weeks seems to reflect more fear than careful thought. Some examples: the University of South Florida canceled a campus visit by 14 African journalists, even though only two members of the group were from countries with Ebola outbreaks. Syracuse University withdrew an invitation to a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who recently returned from Liberia. His appearance was scheduled 3 weeks after his return. And at Navarro College in Texas, a 10,000-student community college located south of Fort Worth has announced it will reject, at least for the moment, all applications from all students who live in Africa. Two questions emerge: just how great a risk is Ebola to students and faculty at the nation's colleges and universities? And what are the clinical and operational attributes of a thoughtful and effective institutional response to the potential risk Ebola might present? Joining us for this conversation are Craig Roberts, who is an epidemiologist for the University Health Services at the University of Madison. Craig also serves as the chair of the American College Health Association's Emerging Public Health Threats and Emergency Response Coalition, and writes a blog for this group. And Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So, Craig, let me turn to you, particularly the day after what we've seen is a lot of media attention to the announcement of an Ebola case in New York City. The public discussion, both the thoughtful and the screaming heads on cable and elsewhere, suggests that Ebola might pose a great risk to colleges and to the public at large. And yet I think many of us have a sense of deja vu here, that we have been here before with SARS a decade ago. Yet the SARS threat was a very different threat, and in many ways potentially a far more dangerous one, because it had a different transmission pattern. It was airborne, whereas Ebola really requires contact with bodily fluids. So, in the context of what we're seeing from the screaming heads on cable, what we see in other media sources, what's the real risk factor for colleges and universities with Ebola?
Well, Casey, I don't think colleges are particularly any greater risk than any other community or population. In fact, in some ways, they're a much lower risk because their population of travelers is, although frequent and international travel is very common, in many cases, people are not traveling to those countries. Those are not the countries where the outbreaks are happening anyway, are not of, places. It's not a particularly common place for students to travel, even for study abroad. So I'm not sure that the risk here is any higher than anywhere else.
And yet, Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, it seems like there's a perception that risk is high, and potentially higher than it might be for the general population. Again, if you look at the cancellations that I cited in the introduction, and others that might be coming.
There's certainly a perception that way, because certainly many colleges boast about their international connections and international students. What we have seen thus far, though, is cancellations that are not called for if you read the CDC guidelines or the American College Health Association recommendations, with colleges, a few colleges at least, canceling appointments of people who have not been exposed to countries with Ebola for longer than 21 days, or to countries in Africa that haven't had Ebola. So in talking about, you talk about the perceived risk that is prompting action, not necessarily the real risk when people have in fact been in areas with high Ebola rates.
Craig, is the perceived risk driving a lot of campus decision making these days? Because people
absolutely
call you and contact the association?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the issues here is, though, I think schools and colleges recognize that any school, any place in the country could potentially be at risk. The next case of Ebola in a traveler returning from a high-risk country in Africa could be in Madison, Wisconsin, or it could be Seattle, Washington. Yesterday it was New York City. And so I think any college administrator is going to have to be concerned about that, and they have to prep themselves in terms of what their response is going to be. How are they going to handle this? How are they going to manage it? The examples we've listed here today, though, to put this in some perspective, those schools are definitely outliers, and I think the vast, vast majority of universities and colleges in the United States have had a really very good and totally appropriate response.
So, Craig, almost 3 months ago, on August 11th, you wrote a Being Prepared for Ebola piece for the American College Health Association. As I read that, it seemed to me that you were focusing more on sort of the clinical as opposed to the larger operational kinds of issues. Can you walk us through that a little bit? What are the elements of a thoughtful and well-reasoned campus response, campus planning?
Sure. And that blog post originally was sort of, again, that was a while ago, and things have changed a lot in 3 months. We were trying to sort of get our members to think about keeping things in perspective, that Ebola is not the only disease or infection out there you need to worry about in students who are returning from international travel, of course, and much of that happens at the end of August as people return to campuses across the country. But our membership is college health centers, and so it is a primarily a clinical focus in terms of what you need to do in your college health center to be prepared. These are the things you need to think about. You need to be screening your students for their travel history. That was sort of the emphasis of that, and that is really where we are still today, I think, in terms of colleges and universities. The issue of international travel has probably become the single most, not necessarily divisive, but it's really the topic that has had the most probably discussion and consideration.
Craig, Scott mentioned the CDC guidelines. Is there a sense, as you talk with your colleagues in health centers, and again, people query the association, that the CDC guidelines have proven to be useful and informative for campuses?
Yes, and I think people look to those guidelines because, particularly for this disease, there has been nothing really out there. This is not something any of us have encountered in the United States before. We have no experience managing people with Ebola or a response to Ebola or the more typical situation, a suspect case. So what I've been telling my colleagues is you are not preparing for an outbreak of Ebola the way you might prepare for an outbreak of influenza. You are preparing to manage a single case appearing in your community. And even more likely, you should be prepared to manage a suspect case, someone who comes in who's had travel and has a fever, and it's going to be 12 or 24 hours before you even know if that's Ebola or if it's malaria. And you have to have the steps in place to process that and to be prepared and have your, in particular, a wider campus perspective to have your emergency preparedness plans ready to go and to have experience in implementing those plans.
Scott, as a journalist, you're kind of the institutional memory for this conversation, and that, you know, the closest thing that I think I can recall to the current conversation about Ebola is the conversation we had on campuses a decade ago about SARS. What do you see in terms of similarity and differences?
Well, certainly similarity is that there was a perception of it coming from other countries, and there were debates over uninviting people from certain countries or restricting travel to certain countries. And this always gets very complicated because even if areas of risk aren't the top areas for study abroad or for research abroad, the reality is American campuses have public health experts. They have public health experts who deal with developing nations. So there are naturally people at American campuses who want to go where something is happening. And colleges and universities historically want to encourage people to engage in the world. So you have in these cases a real tension between the public service teaching and research role of universities and the safety role. You also have a certain set of fear when you have a relatively new to the U.S. Disease that is very scary. And you also have issues that relate to how we treat people from different parts of the world. Right now, American colleges and universities, for instance, are very dependent on students from China and India. They're not terribly dependent on students from Africa. And so certainly people are asking questions about the speed with which some places are disinviting people from Africa, including nations that don't have Ebola.
And Craig, let me turn to you as an epidemiologist in terms of what we learned from the SARS experience. Again, these are very different viruses in one sense. SARS is airborne. Ebola requires contact with bodily fluids. Still, are there lessons from the SARS experience that carry forward?
I think so. From my perspective, that was really probably one of the first times that colleges and universities and the public health system in general sort of had to make a response. So that was 10 years ago. Many of us at that point were, the only real preparedness stuff we were working on was thinking about a coming influenza pandemic, but the presence of SARS sort of woke people up to that. And much like Ebola, the people who were primarily at risk in the United States and Canada from getting that disease were actually the healthcare workers. The risk to the general public was actually pretty low. But we had the same discussions about students. At that time, we had students in China and in Southeast Asia that were potentially at risk. And I can't recall, I think we did pull back one of our programs and pull back our students. So if we had certainly right now, if we'd have students in Liberia, we probably would have done that as well. So Scott is right. I mean, the implications of this in terms of university response it is critical because it's not just U.S. Academic institutions, of course, it's institutions all over the world and from Europe who have much public health expertise and can really be a value in fighting the epidemic in these countries, whether it was SARS or whether it was Ebola or whether it's MERS. But the role of the university, I think one difference now perhaps is that universities seem to be a little more risk averse. I think in the discussions on our own campus, there is, I think, had been a campus counsel and attorney present at every one of these meetings, and I've never encountered that before. So it's an interesting perspective.
And Scott, let's turn to the role of the media. I mean, at one level, there is the threat of the virus, and at the other level, there is the presence of the media, which has just been all over this for the last couple of days. And again, we'll accelerate in the wake of the experience in New York City, in terms of the one physician back from Africa who has now been diagnosed as having Ebola. What's the appropriate media response as somebody who might counsel a college official and as somebody who's covering this as a member of the media?
Well, I something that we've been thinking about a lot. And so, for instance, we have not rushed to publish stories about suspected case at College Y, in part because I tend to notice that a day or two later, most of these suspected cases aren't actually Ebola. But I do worry that some in the media are going with the panic mode. And there are very legitimate reasons for the press to be covering this. We should be covering it, and particularly in communities where cases have come up, and we should be concerned about what's going on in Africa and elsewhere. But there's a certain hysteria in some of the coverage that where I fear the press is encouraging overreaction rather than encouraging thoughtful decision-making.
Let me push on that a little bit. You know, earlier this week, the New York Times, to cite got story example of one student at a particular institution ran a story about a student at Yale who had recently returned from Africa, had a fever, was thought potentially to present Ebola, ultimately did not. As these things pop up, as they may, because we're going into the flu season, could be some other ailment that, that affects students, and again, Ebola is so much in the mind and so much in the media. What do you tell your colleagues in campus health centers when these issues, when these students present themselves? What do you say to campus officials about what should be the response in terms of the public presentation of what we're doing at a particular college or university?
Well, there's a fairly clear protocol to follow in terms of the clinical management of these people, right? So in Yale followed that and other places where we know what to do, and these are the steps we go through. A huge part of that is communication, so communicating to your student body, to your administrators about what's going on and being open and frank and so on. But it also, you have to draw the line somewhere because there are also issues of release of information and privacy issues around FERPA and HIPAA that we can't often discuss details of a case. And this comes up with other outbreaks and other diseases too, but typically we do not go public with a lot of information about the health care of our students. When someone comes in with X, Y, or Z disease, we don't usually put out a press release and make an announcement about that. So it is a balancing act between what's sort of the public right to know versus what's the student's privacy. And I think in most cases with this disease, we think there's a public benefit to knowing that there's a case, or even a suspect case in some cases. Although I think usually people are wary of putting out that information until they get more information and it's confirmed. But this is clearly, this is with SARS, this is something that generates a very emotional response in people rather than a simply rational and scientific response. And we recognize that it happens with diseases that are rare and scary and vivid in our imagination. And that's very different than something like influenza where it's, again, routine and people sort of are used to it. I would say there was the story in the New York Times this morning about the New York case. The governor was quoted with what I thought was a really great quote here. A little anxiety can keep you safe. It's not a bad thing, but undue anxiety is unproductive. And that's really true, I think.
And that may be a great way to close our conversation. A little anxiety can be helpful. Undue anxiety just takes you over the edge. Craig Roberts, thank you very much for joining us for the conversation about Ebola. Thanks, too, to Scott Jasek. And also we want to thank Nancy Sims, who joined us on the first segment to talk about copyright issues. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you for joining us today.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.